North Idaho News of the Week is brought to you in part by Evergreen Realty, commercial and residential property listings. Online at evergreen-realty.com. Good morning. It's Friday, April 12th. I'm Jack Peterson, and this is North Idaho News of the Week. Without Chris Bessler this week, it'll just be me, but I am pleased to be joined by the Sandpoint Reader's editor, Zach Hagedon, this morning to discuss the week in news. Good morning, Zach.
Good morning.
And always nice to have you here in the studio. I will start with a little state news. The House Bill 710, well, for one thing, the House and Senate have adjourned for the year. So the business of the legislature is officially laid to rest, barring them calling themselves or being called by the governor into emergency session later in 2024. House Bill 710, the harmful materials bill, the library bill, was signed by Governor Brad Little and goes into effect on July 1st of this year. It will allow children or their parents to file a legal claim against a public or school library if they obtain materials deemed harmful to minors. Children or parents receive $250 in statutory damages plus any actual damages determined by the court. Also, a county prosecuting attorney or attorney general will have cause of action for injunctive relief against any school or public library that violates the bill's ban on promoting, giving, or making available to children material that's considered harmful to minors. It relies on Idaho's legal definition of material harmful to minors, which includes any act of homosexuality under its definition of sexual conduct. And the bill also amends Idaho's legal definition to add a definition of schools that include any public or private school that provides K-12 instruction. Libraries will have to have a form for people to request a review of materials, and that any materials that are requested to be moved have, I believe, 60 days to be moved to a restricted or adults-only area. If the library has reasonable cause to believe that the minor was at least age 18 or verification that the minor was accompanied by a parent or guardian, that would be an affirmative defense to any civil cause of action that the library would face as laid out in the bill. So that was signed by Governor Brad Little. He also signed on March 27th, I believe, Senate Bill 1374. This limits leaseholder rights to regulate weapons on public property. This bill was proposed and championed by District 1 Senator Scott Herndon of Sagal, an issue with which he has significant local history and which we will be discussing later on in this program with Mr. Hagedon, who wrote an article in this week's Reader on Newsstands Now. The governor also signed House Bill 538, enacting protections for public employees unwilling to use preferred pronouns. This would prohibit any government entity from compelling a public employee to use preferred personal titles or pronouns that do not correspond with the biological sex of an individual, and allow an employee to sue if they are requested to use an individual's preferred pronouns. This is particularly of note for educators who are public employees as well. So this would allow teachers who choose not to use an individual or students' preferred pronouns to continue not using them and allow them to sue if they face any kind of reprimand or disciplinary action for that refusal. I already mentioned that the House and Senate have now adjourned for the year. Here in Bonner County, Commissioner Williams of District 2, her district reports will return as agendized items. This was kind of a lingering controversy and point of contention between the Williams, well, Williams, the individual, and her political allies, as well as versus the other two members of the County Commission, Luke Ahmet, the chairman, and Steve Bradshaw, representing District 1. Reports were considered to be, or Williams had proposed to bring the reports as simply as public comment as a member of the general public. They will now return as agendized items rather than as public comment from her. And that apparently putting that issue to bed. The trespass controversy also concluded. Rick Kramer is now free to attend meetings. This dates back to January of this year when he and Dave Bowman were asked to leave the building and removed from the building by Sandpoint Police. The trespass order has been dropped, and now Kramer is free to attend meetings. It's unclear to me, at least, whether Bowman is also free to attend meetings or is still barred from entering the building. I'm not totally sure about that. Work continues at Traverse Park on the James T. Russell Sports Complex. I'll do a little first-person reporting and say that I passed by this morning. The roof and walls are in place on the structure, and it looks to be nearing completion. Down in Coeur d'Alene, North Idaho College had their credit rating downgraded by Moody's for the second time in 2 years. This is not to be confused with their accreditation status, which is still up in the air, but they... their credit rating has been downgraded, which will affect their ability to raise funds and raise credit. Right now, that's all that I mean, of course, plenty of other things going on in town, but for now, that'll do it for a rundown of the headlines. And Zach Hagedon is here, as mentioned, from the Sandpoint Reader. Here in the Reader, you have a more than one page, but not quite two page article detailing the House bill or Senate bill 1374, which is that one championed by our Senator Scott Herndon of SAGL. This is the I don't know what the official subtitle of the bill was, but or the official title of the bill was, but it will be to regulate the or to limit the leaseholder rights to regulate weapons on public property. I guess this would be a good time to probably start with kind of the story of how Herndon, first as an individual before he was a legislator, became so involved in this issue. Do you want to tell that tale?
Yes, of course. Okay. I've told that tale many times. Mm-hmm. As my esteemed colleagues at the Sandpoint Reader, I think we may well have spilled more ink on this particular story than any other for many, many years. Certainly since I came back into my role as the editor in 2019, which is when this really began. If people can remember back that far, in time, there was an incident at the festival at Sandpoint during that summer's concert series where Scott Herndon, then a civilian activist for many causes, including gun rights, he and a fellow resident of the county, Scott Avery, had attempted to enter the festival grounds with weapons, with firearms. And were told to leave their guns in their vehicles or be trespassed from the property. This was festival security telling them this. They challenged the legality and constitutionality of a private entity leasing public property, that is War Memorial Field. They challenged the ability for that private leaseholder to regulate weapons on public property because Idaho has a portion of state law that specifically prohibits public entities from regulating firearms on public property. It's called the preemption law. And there are some stipulations, of course. I mean, like, you know, jails, they don't allow weapons in the jail other than, you know, by the police, courthouses, schools, universities, stadiums, things like that. I mean, there are carve outs, but generally speaking, like a public park, such as War Memorial Field, under the preemption law, a public agency can't tell you not to bring your gun onto that property.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the argument by the city of Sandpoint, which is the entity that leases that property to the festival, their argument was all along that they're not making any policy. So the city of Sandpoint is not making a policy. You can't bring your gun to the festival.
Mm-hmm.
The festival is making that policy. And the festival, as a private leaseholder, has that right under its lease to do so. So the city of Sandpoint was saying, look, I mean, yeah, we get it that the preemption law exists, that public entities cannot regulate firearms on public property, you know, within these certain bands of acceptance, but we're not doing that. So why are you suing us? Mm-hmm. You know, because this resulted in a lawsuit. famously, beginning with Bonner County, Sheriff Darrell Wheeler signed on to a lawsuit for this, claiming that the festival's policy and the city's involvement as the lessor created some confusion for law enforcement about how to trespass people if they were legally putting themselves in jeopardy by trespassing folks off of the public property. So, I mean, he claimed he wanted clarity on the law. Bonner County commissioners got involved. Former commissioners, I think only Steve Bradshaw is still on the board from the three that were there at the time. Anyway, this lawsuit went on and on and on, ended up costing more than $300,000+. The court agreed with the city's perspective, which the city had all along, that the city was not making a policy to regulate firearms. The lessee, the festival, had the right under its lease to do so, and they threw out the case. Well, Scott Herndon, being sort of the animus of the original issue, got together with the Idaho Second Amendment Alliance, which is a Boise-based gun rights lobby group, and with the Idaho Second Amendment Second Amendment Foundation, which is based in like Washington somewhere. They got some money behind this, and they filed another suit challenging it on sort of that legal parameter, you know, saying like, we need clarity on what the rights are of a leaseholder on public property. That case also was thrown out with the judge saying, like, yeah, we already said that, you know, the festival has the power to do this under its lease. They appealed it. They, being Herndon et al., appealed it to the Idaho Supreme Court. Idaho Supreme Court threw it out last June saying, yeah, the festival has the right to regulate weapons on public property if it has a lease. It's not in violation of the preemption law because it's not the city of Sandpoint making this decision. Herndon at the time promised that he would bring a legislative solution to what he considered to be this loophole, quote unquote, in Idaho law. And that is where we ended up with Senate Bill 1374, which is his successful attempt so far, to write in further stipulations to this leaseholder right to regulate weapons. Now, what the bill does is says that a private lessee of public property can only regulate firearms on, you know, public property if it's a ticketed event, if it is clear to a reasonable person that it is not open to the public generally, and that it is what is an interesting phrase here in the legislation. I'm trying to find it. It's a normally and habitually open to the public. So the property cannot be normally and habitually open to the public. So basically all events on public property, they're going to regulate firearms, have to be very private.
Yeah.
Invitation only, ticketed, you know, in some cases.
Yeah.
And not normally and habitually open to the public. This is causing some consternation at the festival. For one thing, we reached out to them because they were sort of at the center of this whole issue to begin with. And their response to us, you know, when we asked them how this might affect their operations, was that, well, it's going to make it impossible to do free events on any sort of public property when the performers don't want to be there if there's going to be weapons. And this has been the festival's argument all along for the reason why they have a weapons ban. I mean, in addition to sort of just the general sense of safety with not having armed people wandering around, during a concert, is that performers' contracts these days will not tolerate weapons in a venue.
I mean, yeah.
Most performers, I mean, there are some who won't, who don't care,
mm-hmm.
but when they go to book acts, like if they find out that there's going to be guns in the crowd, then artists are saying, well, I'm not going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're doing a free concert anywhere on public property, it's being leased by a private entity and it's not being ticketed and it's not being sort of regulated as a non-public space, then, there's going to be guns there. The city of Sandpoint is still trying to figure out what this means for when it signs leases with folks.
Mm-hmm.
They're preparing to renew the lease for the festival as they do every year prior to the summer concert series. And Mayor Jeremy Grimm told me that they had not accounted for this legislation in those negotiations yet, because this just passed. I mean, like 2 weeks ago or something, or Governor Little just signed it a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. It would seem that the festival, which is a ticketed event and which is not just open to the public to
right.
walk to come and go as they please, that they would still be able to bar
yes.
people with weapons from entering the facilities.
Yes.
And
Senator Herndon was very clear with me when I, mm-hmm. when I asked him, like, how will this affect the festival? He says it will not affect the festival mm-hmm. in its general, concert summer series, because it is a ticketed event. The entrances and the exits are regulated. Mm-hmm. It is not, normally and habitually open to the public. People can't just wander in.
Yeah.
However, when I asked the festival, they said, well, we also do free events,
mm-hmm.
so they won't be able to do that probably. The other sort of unintended perhaps consequence is that, we focus so much on the festival in this story and have for years because they were at the center of the initial issue.
Yeah.
But as we have reminded people every time we've written a story about this, is that the festival is not the only private entity that leases public property from the city.
Mm-hmm.
There are other entities, such as the Panhandle Special Needs facility out there on Boyer.
Mm-hmm.
They rent from the city, and Bonner General Health, our downtown hospital. Critical components of its campus are on city property. And we have asked this question numerous times about, does the preemption law apply to sort of the ER or the patient intake area? Does this law now sort of require that the hospital allow firearms to be in those locations? We didn't get an answer to that. I asked the mayor what his interpretation was, sort of suggesting to him, like, okay, my reading of this says that, we've got a private entity, the hospital, renting public property.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not you consider the hospital to be normally and habitually open to the public, I guess, is up for interpretation. So, I honestly don't know the answer.
Yeah.
And I would like to know the answer because, Senator Herndon says, no, that wouldn't apply to the hospital because it's not normally and habitually open to the public. But I don't know how you assess that. Who does that? I have a very strong feeling that at some point, somewhere in Idaho, this is going to show up in court again, which is deeply unfortunate for, I think, from the perspective of some of these public officials. Mayor Grimm said to me that it would be very disappointing if we had to go relitigate this after we went through multiple levels of the court process all the way to the Idaho Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
Seeking clarity. And now we have less clarity, perhaps, from some perspectives. But in an effort to, I guess, in Herndon's words, take back some ground, quote unquote, for Idaho gun owners, because he was displeased with the numerous rejections of these lawsuits. But there we are.
Is the East Bonner County Library considered public property? Would you be aware of that?
That one I'm not aware of. I would need to go.
Yeah.
Look at the GIS. The city's website.
I don't think it's owned by the city, but I guess it is probably something that you would find out. You will find out in court.
Yeah, there, I think that if we really scratched this issue a little deeper, we might find that there's a lot of places that we don't necessarily think of as being public property that are mm-hmm. that are being leased. I think that the library is probably a special case.
Yeah,
I'm just speculating, but. But the city owns a lot of property, and
there's
and the state owns a lot of property, and those pieces of property are often rented or leased by private purposes, or for private purposes, and used by people in that capacity. And this law is directly aimed at, you know, putting guardrails around what you can and can't say, related to weapons on those pieces of property. So
there are, I'm only aware of one in the city of Sandpoint. I don't even know if it still exists, but like residences can be owned by the city and leased to private property. You know, I mean, people can live on what is essentially public property and hold a lease to that land, which of course they wouldn't necessarily have to allow guns. But if in a different city, if you are, you know, if could there be a situation where now you have to have clearly posted everywhere on your property that guns are not allowed in
you need to have a, you wouldn't let anybody come into your house unless they paid you. You
know, right.
I mean, entrance to your home would be ticketed, or it would be a clearly marked private event, or, you know, there's all these different things. I mean, after the Supreme Court ruling, you know, we thought that we had the final word with, you know, absolute clarity that the possessor, like the rights of a leaseholder basically turn public property into private property during the terms of the lease. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to answer all these questions, is they can do whatever they want, basically. Now we're being told, no, there's, you know, here's an instance, there's an instance, et cetera, et cetera. So now we're going to have to sort of find the boundaries of this. And unfortunately, I personally feel like we're going to see this in court. And I don't know if it gets thrown out again. I have no idea. But here we are now talking about this issue again.
Yes. And venturing into the realm of speculation a little bit, I think we will just have to wait and see, I guess, when and if it does end up in court.
It will be tested, I'm sure.
Yeah.
As all laws are.
Let's see. We should mention you, Zach Hagedon, were not always here at the Reader. You were the editor of the Boise Weekly at one point. Do you feel you still have your finger on the pulse of the big city down south?
I actually worked at the Associated Press in the Capitol building when I was a young man. Uh-huh. I was an Associated Press staffer in the basement of the old Capitol before the renovation, even.
Mm-hmm.
I worked at the Idaho Business Review, a few short blocks from the Capitol for a time, and I was business editor, freelancer, and editor-in-chief of the Boise Weekly.
Mm-hmm.
So I have spent a sizable portion of my journalism career in the City of Trees, and I do have a grudging affection for our Capitol.
Well, were you surprised to see Little's signature on some of these bills? The library bill, which was controversial to say the least, and we know that it's actually here in the Reader. I think there were some interesting statistics on the kind of public response that he was getting. I think if you can hear me flipping the pages on the microphone. Yeah, Little's office received over 7,000 emails and calls in opposition to House Bill 710 versus about 4,250 in favor of the legislation. So I would say overwhelmingly opposed to that legislation. And other controversial bills like the pronoun bill and the bill we were just talking about, the Senate Bill 1374. All of them not just passed without his signature, but with his approval.
Yeah. I mean, as it seems kind of quotidian to say such a thing, but it's, you know, it all comes down to politics.
Yeah.
I think if you want the answer to why Governor Little, who has been known to veto bills,
he has,
that are popular sort of red meat kind of partisan bills from his own party, he has vetoed these before. I mean, he's vetoed a library bill.
Yep.
Referring to it as a library bounty,
mm-hmm.
you know, that was sort of encouraging people to sue libraries on subjective grounds of, you know, sort of what their tastes or dislikes are, mm-hmm. you know, regarding books. He didn't like that bill in previous sessions, but this time around here, he signs it. And I think he was pretty clear in his comments that he didn't necessarily want to sign it, but that he felt like lawmakers had done their work, you know, to sort of like change the law a little bit, that made him feel a little better about it. So now he's going to reward them by signing it. You know, it felt very much like a consolation prize, kind of an attaboy, like pat him on the head for effort. Like, thanks for bringing this back three times in a row, and now you're going to get your way. And I think that has a lot to do with the primary election coming up in May. I think it has a lot to do with the state of the Idaho Republican Party, to be honest. If you listen to, you know, Mike Moyle, Speaker of the House, and the Republican House leadership, which got together and had a little press conference after adjournment on Wednesday, they said this was a great session. It was a wonderful session. We all got along. We passed some really important bills, et cetera, et cetera. You look at some other analysis and they say, well, this was one of the most fractious, internally divided legislative sessions in recent memory because the Republican Party is having an existential crisis. Just look at any letters to the editor page in any of your local newspapers and you might see the phrase RINO at least a half dozen times. Republican in name only.
Yeah.
Because the Republican Party in Idaho is undergoing an internal sort of bloodletting where they got rid of leadership this session, an unheard of move. Megan Blanksma was just sort of yanked out of leadership. During the primary session, you have Republicans running against Republicans and claiming that, you know, the other person is not really a Republican. Like, so this notion of what is a real Republican in Idaho is now very much at the center of the party's politics. And you see Little trying to thread the needle between, you know, this Freedom Caucus, quote unquote, sort of group of people, which includes Senator Herndon, trying to appease them by signing in some of these sort of red meat partisan bills, like why we need legislation that formally and legally defines sex and gender is unknown to me, but politically it makes a lot of sense for these people who are running in their primary and trying to prove who's the real Republican back in their home districts. That was one of the ones that, you know, they sort of Mike Moyle and the other leaders of the House Republicans highlighted during their session with the reporters down in Boise, saying that, you know, these are things that Idahoans want. This is what we've been hearing from Idahoans, that this is what they want, and we're just doing what Idahoans want us to do. However, you can counter that pretty easily by saying, you know, sort of referring to what you were referring to, Jack, about how the governor gets, you know, 7,000 phone calls and emails saying, don't pass the library bill.
Yeah.
And he passes it. So, I mean, but when you put that to somebody like Mike Moyle, which a reporter did, and he says, well, you know, polls are just, you know, polls aren't always accurate. That doesn't really tell you what the reality is out there. So they're building a narrative within their caucus saying that, you know, the majority of Idahoans actually want the library bill, actually want this pronoun bill. They actually want this law defining sex and gender. They're saying, they're telling themselves that they're doing the people's business. And that's just sort of what election seasons are about. They're going to go home to their districts and say, this is what I did for you. See, I'm the real Republican. My opponent is actually a RINO, et cetera. And Little has been very, very much targeted by certain folks in the legislature, including Heather Scott, you know, our former District 1 representative, who referred to him as Little Hitler during the COVID pandemic for his actions. I mean, he's been labeled and tarred with this RINO label many, many times. So I think he's trying to win back some of his street cred, you know, with the hard right folks, because they have really shifted the legislature significantly to the right after the past election. I mean, especially the Senate in particular. I mean, you look back historically at Idaho politics in the state house, and the House has been sort of the wild and woolly kind of right-wing populist group, where the Senate has traditionally been the check.
Yeah.
Now, that changed after the last cycle, and we're seeing the ramifications of that now.
Yeah. Little is 70 years old. He's in his second term as governor and will face re-election, I believe, in 2026. He's not term limited, so he could run again, and he would be 72, I suppose, at that time.
And he has spent a very long time in Idaho politics as a lawmaker, as lieutenant governor, as governor now. I mean, you want to call him a career politician, I think that's a fair label for him. But again, he's signing these bills, I think, to kind of keep the peace within the party, because he sees just how fractious it's becoming. I mean, you can't have a one party state for this long without, you know, the big tent turning into, you know, circling the wagons and shooting inward. Because, I mean, you have no enemies at a certain point other than people who are within your party, and that's what we see.
Yeah.
And we're seeing in our local elections, too.
Well, it is 8:32, and it is time for us to sign off. This week's reader is full of news, information, and a wrap-up of the legislature, as well as local and county issues, and is on newsstands now. Zach, you are editor of that paper, the Sandpoint Reader, and anything else you want to say about that? Anything coming up in next week's that we should look forward to?
Well, speaking of elections, keep an eye out for our candidate questionnaires, which will be coming out in phases. Mm-hmm. We're going to do one on the county candidates and one on the state legislative candidates, and that'll be coming out the next couple weeks, and then we're going to have some forums.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be a lot more information about that coming up, so please be aware.
There in both forums, on the 29th and the 30th, the 30th is going to be hosted by the Reader, but both forums will be broadcast on KRFY. We believe both forums are at 5:30 in the evening at the Sandpoint High School auditorium, if you'd like to attend in person, or you can listen right here on these airwaves, and we'll have a recording available after the fact as well on our website. But Monday the 29th and Tuesday the 30th. Tuesday the 30th is the one that the Reader will be coordinating.
Right, and they're both going to be very interesting, I'm sure. We have a deep slate of candidates, a lot of ideas, a lot of tension even between some of these candidates. So yeah, it'll be an important cycle to pay attention to.
It will. The primary election is on May 21st. If I'm not mistaken.
That is correct.
We will now resume our regularly scheduled programming. It's time for Otto's Eclectic Mix here on 88.5 KRFY. Thanks for listening to North Idaho News of the Week, and we'll be back 1 week from today with what happens next. Thank you, Zach.
Thank you.